Hello, welcome to Growing Wild, sponsored by Infinity Foods, on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online and on digital. I'm Charlotte Petz, and coming up on this show, we have Ruth from the Brighton & Hove Organic Gardening Group talking to us about the benefits of being organic and the event that they held here at the open market earlier in the month. Richard Cobden from Sussex Wildlife Trust talks to us about their initiative for June, which is called 30 Days Wild. We've got a report from Beryl about the Norfolk Square Community Garden that happened again earlier this month. And finally, I caught up with Susanna Steer of Barkham Romneys to see how her first year of being a shepherdess with her own flock has been. But first of all, let's have a song, and this is Waterloo Sunset. Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. I saw him actually at, I went to the Olympic closing ceremony back in 2012, and it was just, oh wow, it was such an experience, and you saw all these incredible artists and everything. And whenever I hear that, I just remember sitting in that stadium with thousands and thousands and thousands of other people and all the athletes on the track and everything, and oh, it was quite a memory. The first item we've got coming up on the show is Ruth from the Brighton & Hove Organic Gardening Group, also known as BOG. They held a day here in the open market where we broadcast from, and it was a gardening day, so there were lots of different stalls going on, and they had a big presence there, and with Seedy Sunday, which is something I cover every year as well, which is an annual seed swap amongst other things. And they were here just trying to promote organic gardening and to get people to join their group. And I'll let Ruth tell you more about it. And she was a member from, well, she started it really from about 15 years ago, a bit of a pioneer. And this is her just telling us a bit more about the group.
The main aim of the group, okay, so the main aims have always been to encourage and support organic gardeners in the community. So what I can do, as a result of having helped to start this up, I've put myself through the horticultural studies at Stanmer and Plumpton and so on, so that I actually would have a reasonable level of gardening knowledge that was backed up by proper, you know, proper educational qualifications and
sure,
things.
Yeah.
And so we teach people if they want to learn. And in fact, somebody came along today who's just taken on a neglected allotment, and I've probably spent half an hour on and off chatting with her and given her some bits of advice, and she's gone, oh, thank you so much, that's just really helpful to know that that's a good idea and that that's going to be more vulnerable to slugs and snails and that this is a good thing to do to suppress ground elder and all of those kinds of things. So because there's a lot of us that have got a reasonable amount of experience, then we can pass on what we know to people who are complete beginners, and just try and spread the word about how good it is to be organic, how important it is for the whole planet and so on.
Yeah, so what are your main reasons for being organic?
It's better for humans because the food is more nutritious. There are studies now to show that organic food actually does contain particularly certain things that have, that there's more in organic food than in non-organic food. And also there's no pesticide residues, and this is one of the major things, that there's such a lot of pesticide residues in so many ordinarily produced foodstuffs. So that's number one, and number two, kind of along with that, is that over the last 60-70 years, the amount of minerals contained in foods has really gone down dramatically. And because we're actually making the soil healthier with organic growing, then it's got the potential to have a lot more nutrients in the food. Number two is that industrialised farming has actually really quite messed up the planet over the last 70 years. It's destroyed habitats for wildlife. We've lost such a significant amount of wildlife over the last 60, 70 years. I mean, there's some species that have gone extinct, and there are others where the numbers are down easily 50%. Farmland birds in particular really plummeted. Apparently they're starting to come back up a little bit now, but they really, really plummeted by 50%. Hedgehogs plummeted by 50%. Bees have plummeted by 50%, and it's all down to the destruction of the habitats and the use of the poisons.
Yeah.
So this is where organic farming and organic gardening are both better for wildlife, because there are toxin-free food plants for them, for both their young, you know, for the larva and for the adult. Because conventionally farmed fields of things like oilseed rape, for instance, which a lot of bees will use, are treated generally with neonicotinoids, which then will poison the bees and a lot of other insects. And it also washes off so that the wildflower verges around the fields are incredibly poisonous. So it sounds like, oh great, the farmers are reintroducing wildflowers, but actually those wildflowers are full of poisonous toxic
residues.
Yeah,
it's no good. As long as the pesticides are continuing to be used, then it's just, they get inside all of the plants.
So better for humans, better for wildlife, better for the soil, because, and this is why the Soil Association was formed in 1945, I think it was, which is, how long ago is that? It's over 70 years, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because there were, there were various doctors and scientists and farmers that were really concerned that even back then, soil health was declining because organic matter wasn't being put back into it, and because poisonous pesticides and herbicides and soluble fertilizers and so on were being put on the soil, which actually deplete the soil organisms, and so the soil stopped being so healthy. And if you're not producing, if you're not tending to the soil, if you're not taking proper care, then we're losing, the world is losing the equivalent of 39 football fields a minute of good topsoil, because it's eroding, because there's just not the organic matter in it to hold it down. It's just turning to dust. And they reckon that we've only got about 40, if we don't do something to change things, then we've only got about 40 years left of being able to grow stuff.
Right, yeah.
And yet the agrochemical companies are saying industrial farming is the only way forward to feed the world, and it's a load of nuts. 70%.
Where profit gets in the way of health and creating our food, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's really worrying. So organisations like you, who speak to people, grassroots level, people who are taking on allotments for the first time, people who don't know how it all works and what they need to do, this is great. You're informing them.
We are informing them. We're encouraging them to buy organic, because there's 50% more wildlife on organic farms. And if you buy organic, or even like locally, we can quite easily get hold of food that may not be registered organic, but there's places like Hisby that will take in food from farmers who don't use any pesticides, but they can't afford the registration to be organic.
Okay.
But we know that it's being grown without the use of chemical fertilisers and toxic pesticides. And so it is organic, even though it's not registered organic. So as the more people realise that actually, if they spend a little bit more, spend about 10p more on milk, for instance, to get organic milk, we're actually really encouraging and putting the money into the organic farms.
It's taking back our power, isn't it? And it always seems to come back down to where you spend your money.
Yeah.
And we do have that power where we choose to spend our pound. They have to take note of that. They have to listen to that. So it's really important just to make those little changes. For sure. So what are you doing here at the open market today? What's the event today?
We've got seven stalls, seven tables. Mm-hmm. And so we brought seedlings, and we're also very, very closely associated with Seedy Sunday. Mm-hmm. Seedy Sunday actually grew out of our organisation.
Oh, is that right?
This was the first Seedy Sunday in the country.
Yes,
the
Brighton
one.
Yeah.
And it's spread all over the place now, and it actually grew out of our group. So that's brilliant, and we're still very, we're still just the best mates. And a lot of people are in both the organisations. And so we've got seeds that are left over from Seedy Sunday, that seeds of things that will grow now, for peas and beans and various leaves and things like that. So we're doing a bit of selling, but also we're here more just to try and increase our membership. because it's great to be a member of this organisation, because we do try and promote organic practices in a broad area of community things. And just chatting to people and saying, okay, you can just do this and it will make a difference. So
you're really passionate about this, aren't you, about spreading?
I am. I did a degree in ecology 50 years ago. When nobody knew the word ecology.
Yeah.
So I actually learned about what we were doing to the planet long before most people realised what we were doing.
So where can people find you
We've got a website.
Good.
We've got a website, ehorganicgardeninggroup.org.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for having a chat, Ruth. Good luck with the rest of your day here.
Thank you.
That was a brilliant Ruth from Bog. And as she said, her website there, and I will put that link up on the Growing Wild show page, which is on radioreverb.com. They do such great work. I'm a big fan of them. They really do have quite a lot of events that go on across the city, so do check them out if you're interested in what she's saying. And it just so mirrors what other people on this show have said. You know, Dave Goulson, who's the bee man, who's just an incredible advocate for non-use of pesticides, and Nick Mole as well from a couple of shows back from the Pesticide Action Network. Yeah, it's just the same message really. We just don't need to use these pesticides, and it's just the agrochemical companies telling us that we do. I do realise that I am very much swayed towards that persuasion, and maybe one day I'll have someone on telling me why maybe we do need them, and just for the interests of balance. But at the moment, I'm pretty convinced that we don't need them. Another fact that really surprises me that both Dave has said and Ruth mentioned actually is that worldwide 70% of our food is created on a local scale. So the fact that these companies are saying that we need this mass agriculture just isn't true. 70% of our food can already be grown without using it. The facts are already there. There's a great book by somebody called Rachel Carson, and it's called Silent Spring. And it came out in the 60s. It was actually 1962. And it tells, and that was when chemical use was just incredibly high, because the end of World War II came and these companies that had been making all these chemicals for the war suddenly didn't have a customer anymore. So they started making them into pesticides that we use on our gardens and on food crops, which is astounding, really. And it got to such a point in the 60s that it was so potent that Rachel Carson wrote this book. And it's really very good. If you'd like to learn more about all of this information, it's brilliant. And it's from the 60s. She had so much foresight. And it actually came then that the American government changed their policies around pesticides as a result of this book. So it's called Silent Spring. And I would encourage you very much to read it. Okay, let's have a song. We're going to have Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys. And then we'll be back hearing about what the Wildlife Trust is up to for the month of June.
I love colourful clothes she wears, and the way the sunlight plays upon her head.
As the Beach Boys and Good Vibrations. I've always seemed to have a little story after these songs, but I was in a pantomime when I was younger, and I think I must have been about 10, and I was the sun, and I was dressed as this massive sun, and I had to sing that song amongst others, and at one point I got pushed off the stage. So that's a nice little anecdote. So next up we've got Richard Cobden from Wildlife Trust telling us about what their project is for June, and it's called 30 Days Wild. And I'll let him tell you about it, but it's a great project and I'm really keen to promote it. So this is Richard telling us a little bit more about the Wildlife Trust and then this project that they're launching for June.
There's pretty much a Wildlife Trust for every county across the country, and all of them come together to do 30 Days Wild.
What is 30 Days Wild?
30 Days Wild is simply a fun way of getting people outside to engage with nature in as easy a way as is possible. The idea is that everyone does one wild thing for every day for the 30 days of June.
And by wild, you don't mean, you know, sort of partying on top of a building and that sort of thing. You're talking nature-based.
Yeah. No, we mean something where you get out and connect with nature. it doesn't have to be anything complicated or anything you need a biology degree for or anything like that. It can be something as simple as walking barefoot on grass or having your lunch outside or maybe seeing how many birds or butterflies you can spot on your walk to school.
Okay, and it is the idea to do something different every day, could you repeat some things?
The rules aren't hard and fast, so whatever suits you and whatever you're doing within your everyday life. Ideally, you would do something different each day, but we have found people in previous years, they've done one thing and then have kind of expanded on the theme. Perhaps something like someone had tried wildlife photography, and then maybe for some of their later challenges, they try to photograph flowers of a certain colour or something like that.
Okay, so it can be a discovery for people. They may find something that they didn't realise that they liked and then really explore that and expand on that.
Oh, definitely. And we would encourage people to use it as an opportunity to maybe go to nature reserves or parks or some of the countryside of Sussex that they haven't explored before. Also, the Wildlife Trust runs lots of events. If people can look on our website, sussexwildlifetrust.org.uk, there's plenty of ways you can get involved on there.
Okay, and if people are struggling with ideas, you know, 30 days is quite a long stretch. And
yes.
So if people are needing some inspiration, what sort of information can you provide for them?
The Wildlife Trust have set up a website which has 50 or even more what they're calling random acts of wildness. Now, the random acts of wildness is this little thing that you can do on your average day just to bring a bit more nature into your life. So you can Google 30 Days Wild. You will be able to find that site, and it has so many choices there, from drinking wine in the garden to following a bee or see the ducks at your local pond. There's just so many ideas there, really.
Yeah, so we're not talking grand scale things. It really is just those little things, really, just to get us outside a bit more.
No, definitely. It is just, I mean, there's been plenty of studies done recently which have shown that people are unfortunately getting increasingly disconnected from nature. So we're just using this as a way to bring it back into people's lives, and hopefully after the 30 days, people will still keep up that contact with nature, be it with walks in the countryside or going to the beach or maybe building a hedgehog house.
If people do find something that they like, then that's a really lovely thing for them to discover, isn't it? And hopefully they will carry on doing that. You've got packs available, I believe, have you, for different organisations? So if you're maybe a part of a school, or it can be your workplace, or just on an individual basis?
Yes. I mean, most people sign up on an individual basis, but there are for schools and for businesses, because it's a great way for maybe the well-being of your staff if they would like to get involved in something like this. And it's a bit different from sort of the usual charity asks. I mean, we're not asking for any money or donations through this. It is purely just a bit of your time just to go and do something in the outside world.
Yeah, so tell me a bit more about the Wildlife Trusts. What is it that you do? What's the organisation about?
Well, we are the largest conservation organisation in Sussex. We cover East and West Sussex as well as Brighton and Hove. We have over 30 nature reserves all across Sussex, as well as large reserves like Ditching Beacon or Rye Harbour Nature Reserve. We also run an extensive environmental education programme from our centres, where children from primary school and secondary school will come and experience rock pooling and pond dipping and things like that.
Okay, great. And just tell me again where people can find you and find out more about this project. It's running through the whole of June, that's right, isn't it?
Yes, and there's still plenty of time to sign up, and we've had over 1,000 people in Sussex have already signed up.
So
we're looking forward to it this year. The best place is to visit our website, which is sussexwildlifetrust.org.uk, and there's a big 30 days wild button on the homepage there. And the other aspect of it is, if people do get involved, is we're obviously very keen for people to share their stories on social media. And again, we're just using the hashtag 30 Days Wild on Twitter and Instagram, and the Wildlife Trust's account will then retweet and share those stories so everyone can see just how wild people are getting.
That's great. It's an interesting juxtaposition, isn't it? We're trying to get people outside and then we're kind of telling everyone by being on our screens. It's kind of an interesting two worlds that have to sit next to each other.
Yes, I mean, it is.
I know, it's difficult.
I mean, technology can be used in a good way if it isn't overwhelming in your life. I mean, one of the suggested random acts of wildness is that you have a technology-free day where you just put your phone in a cupboard for the day and just walk around. So, but there is obviously value in sharing what people are doing, and particularly with photography and things like that. Mobile phones are a great asset in that, in that instance.
That was Richard Cobden of the Wildlife Trust there. And it is interesting that we do have to promote these things on social media, even when we're trying to promote getting outside as the thing. that's just, it is two worlds that have to live alongside each other, I guess. But it's such a great idea just to pay attention, just to notice some things that maybe you wouldn't do before. If you head out with that intention, I think it could be a really rewarding thing to see what comes back to you. I think it's someone like John Muir that did the quote that nature will always give back more than you expect if you just go for a walk. He said it a lot more elegantly than that, but it was along, that was the gist. So the link to that will be on the Growing Wild show page on RadioReverb.com. It runs for the month of June, but Richard actually said that some people carry it on for the whole year, so you can have 365 days of wild if you so desire, if it catches your imagination. We're going to have a song and then we've got a report from the Norfolk Square Community Garden. First of all, it's going to be Beirut and No, No, No. Beirut and No, No, No. I love that song. I very rarely play contemporary music on this show, and that one's just got my attention. Good old Six Music, putting that in my earworm library. We've got a piece now from Beryl, who is actually a fellow presenter and producer's mum, and she went off to Norfolk Square earlier in the month, and they had a gardening project there to bring together the local community. It was a crowd-funded project and supported by the council and local businesses to get people together to try and tidy up and clean up and make the space a lot nicer in Norfolk Square in Brighton. And this is Beryl with her piece about the day.
Here we are at Norfolk Square Garden Project. Norfolk Square, a green square between a built-up residential area and Western Road. It's now host to a crowd of people eating, digging, and the music's playing. Let's speak to some of these people and see how things are going today.
Hi, I'm Damien. I'm involved with the Norfolk Square Garden Project. We are trying to regenerate the local square that needs an injection of love, and that is what we're here today to do. There's it's a massive group of people down here today. 150 people, there's music, there's refreshments, and it's turned out to be a brilliant occasion. What we need now is, now the plants are in the ground, we need people to come in and help look after those plants. So anyone that lives local, or if you want to come in from further afield, we are the Norfolk Square Garden Project. You can find us on Facebook and join up and say that you want to help with the gardening, and we would love to have you on.
I'm talking to Daniela Crasvinola. As we are near the sea, do we need any special plants for this area?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The plants that would grow well here, they need to be specifically selected because they need to be much tougher. Yeah. And there is quite a few that we can choose from. I've taken the idea from the nature pattern, so I use the colours that you would naturally find in the season as they are. So you would start with the yellows in the spring, and then you would move into the blues and purples for the summer, and then going into a much deeper red and oranges into autumn, and then we can nicely close it with the white in the winter. This is what you would need.
Yes. I'm just going to introduce you to Rob. We are still in Norfolk Square.
and it's looking very clean.
Yeah,
and full of people
absolutely.
Enjoying themselves.
The amount of man hours that have gone in to getting to this stage has been huge. So we've had a few people who have joined us just because they've heard about the project. They've come along and they just get on. There's something very therapeutic about digging, about putting things into the ground and seeing what you've done. Yeah.
Thank you so much to everyone for being here, and I look forward to my bit of digging.
Isn't that nice? That was a really lovely piece. Community gardens, I think, are massively important, and I am always promoting them. And if you are keen to get involved with a community garden, if you've got some time that you'd like to volunteer, or, you know, especially people that don't have their own gardens, it's such a great way to be able to do some gardening and to meet fellow-minded people and to grow some of your own produce. Brighton and Hove Food Partnership have a huge list of different gardens across the city, and they're great people to talk to, and they can set you up with a project that can fit what you're looking for. That particular one was crowdfunded, and they are still taking donations, so I will put the link for that up on the Growing Wild show page on RadioReverb.com. Thank you, Beryl, for that piece. Okay, this is Growing Wild, and it's sponsored by Infinity Foods on Radio Reverb, and I'm Charlotte Petz. We've got Susanna from Barkham Romney's coming up after this song, and we're going to hear about how her first year has been with her own flock. But first of all, we're going to have Peter Sarzay with Where Do You Go To, My Lovely.
And even suntan on your back and on your legs, and when the snow falls you're found in St. Moritz with the others of the jet set, and you sip your Napoleon brandy, but you never get your lips wet. I know you don't.
That's Peter Sarzay and Where Do You Go To, My Lovely. That's a lovely song. Okay, so Susanna Steer, about a year ago I went out with her and we did a piece of on lambing, and it was brilliant, and I was there when lots of lambs were being born, and it was the first time I'd ever really seen that, and it was all very exciting. And it was for her because it was the first time that she had had her own flock. She's been a shepherdess for many, many years, but then she decided to bite the bullet and to get her own flock. And I just wanted to go back and catch up with her and find out how it's been over this last year to 18 months and what decisions she's had to make and what she may do differently, because she's now come into her second run of lambing. And this is us walking through the field, and she'd written some very polite notices on the gates just for those dog owners that maybe weren't behaving as well as they could do.
Well, that's nice. Put your Facebook page on the warning signs.
If anyone wants to moan at me.
It's a bit
abrupt. You just put dogs on leads. I haven't got room for writing anything else. I thought I'd just put a smiley face on it. Well, yeah, look, here we are. And I put a smiley face in this one, and Barkham Romney's, and my phone number in case anyone wants to phone me.
That's very kind.
So, last time I was here, it was your first year of having your own flock.
Yes.
And we were lambing, and it had gone pretty well. You'd had to intervene on a few because they were quite big lambs, because you'd done a cross between two different breeds, and they came out quite big.
Yeah. I have a theory about why that happened, which wasn't so much because it's the same cross this year and it hasn't happened. The last 6 weeks of their pregnancy is when everything happens. Everything starts growing. And sort of within that 6 weeks, it was quite a harsh section of the winter. And I caved and I fed them. I fed them nuts for 2 weeks. And then when we started lambing, there was 2 weeks where I was having to assist quite a few of the ewes, or about a week where I was having to assist quite a few of them. And then after that, it tailed off and they were all sort of doing it on their own. So I think that coincided with me feeding them. And there was there was a period of time where they were quite big, and then they started sort of balancing out a bit. Let's go through that gap over there. And they didn't, they were starting to be born on their own. And this year I didn't feed them. I offered them hay and they ate a bit of hay. But I thought, if they don't eat the hay, they can't be hungry. They can't be really hungry, because Romneys are so good at converting grass. And it worked really well, so I haven't had to help very many at all. They've all done really well on their own. And the lambs haven't been so enormous as they were last year.
It's a beautiful, hot, sunny day, and they're hiding out in the shade under the trees at the bottom.
What I notice mainly is that you've got different colours.
Oh, I had a moment of weakness at the Seven Sisters Sheep Centre closing down sale. And I went with the intention of having a look at, there were like a few different breeds. I thought, oh, I might, you know, buy them if they're any good. And the Black Welsh Mountains were the first ones, beginning with B, they were the first ones to go through the auction. And I won them. They were £40 each. I didn't really think I'd win them. You know, I was a bit carried away. And anyway, so I really like them. There's four of them. I don't know how old they are. They all had a full set of teeth, and they're really friendly because they've been like petted by the public and stuff. And actually, they've been a real joy. At first, they escaped a few times. We found a few holes in the fence that we didn't know were there before. But apparently, that's what they do. Black Welsh Mountains are quite good at escaping.
What lessons have you learned in this first year that you would change, that you would do differently?
Well, yeah, quite a few things. I'm going to lamb them earlier so that I can shear them earlier, because now I'm waiting for the ewes to sort of settle from having had their lambs before I can shear them. But of course now it's really hot and I have had a couple with maggots, so I've had to sort out. So I have to look at them really carefully every day to see if anybody's got fly strike. Do that differently. After weaning, as I'm going to wean them a bit earlier, the lambs, so the ewes have got longer to recover, and I will pick out any that are slimmer and I will feed them, either put them onto some, I'll have to find some more grazing somewhere, and I'll either have to put them onto, once they've dried off, because after you've weaned them you have to put them onto quite not very good pasture, so that they don't, otherwise I'll get mastitis, you know, so that their milk dries up. And then I'll go through them and I will either feed or find some fresh pasture for the ones that are slim, so I give them more recovery time, because I think that some of them, especially the new ones that I bought, they could have done with a bit more food, because their lambs have been quite small. And the other thing is, you try and flush them on the run up to tupping, so which means you put them on like a better and better diet. They should be on a rising plane of nutrition, so that means it makes them ovulate more eggs. So I've had a lot of singles this year. My lambing percentage is only 145, which isn't very good at all for what I wanted. Last year it was 170, which is about average, which I was really pleased with. So for like every 100 lambs, every 100 ewes that you have, you get 170 lambs, for example. So I've got quite a low lambing percentage this year, even though I had more sheep. But I know other people that said that happened to them as well around here, and it was to do with the weather. But next year, despite what is happening with the weather, I shall, you know, pick out anyone that's slim and make sure that they're being fed well on the run up to tupping, and hopefully that will ensure that they have twins. And it's just a sort of glorified hobby, really, having only 52 ewes. Most farms have got at least 300, if not 1,000, if not 5,000, you know. So I'm just, but you've got to start somewhere, so I'm just growing it slowly and just doing other jobs elsewhere. And
how many each year do you think you can add on?
Thing is, it looks like they've got loads of space here, which they do, but if I want to keep them on the same ground all year round, I can only put them in this field or that field up there. And, you know, the fields need a rest, and in the winter there's less grass. So at the moment we've got masses of grass already, and they'll be fine for months and months. But then in the winter, the last thing I want to do really is have to go to the shops and buy loads of food for the sheep and feed them, because then my profit, it'll just, you know, wipe out.
It's a very tight margin.
Yeah, you get a few more sheep, but then you might have to end up feeding them because you have got less grass. And so I'm looking around for more grazing. I've got a few little places I've been putting little groups of sheep, which is helping. And that gets them out of the way. But I don't want them to be too far away, because then you've got to drive and look at them every day. And when you say about when to sell them as well, that was quite a big learning curve. The lambs are ready in September, which I wasn't expecting, because they were, what, March, April, May, June, July, August. They're only 4 months old, and I was expecting them to be maybe 6 months old before they were ready to go. But they were so fast growing, they were ready within 4 months. So I sold them all in halves or wholes, butchered as you want it, to people in the local area, mostly through Facebook and putting adverts in parish magazines and shop windows. And everyone said it was absolutely beautiful. It was so good. It's because it's straight off its mum, just only eating grass for its whole life of milk, and it had gone straight to the abattoir, straight to the butcher, and I'd taken it straight to someone's door. So it was the freshness of it. So next year I'm going to keep a lot more on, maybe, and try and sell them all as hogget, which is a year to 2 year old lamb. So I've got 12 left now that really look ready. They look amazing. But I've said that I'm going to keep them until the end of summer, but at least July. And then I'm going to sort of take them maybe 2-3 at a time and taste them and see when is the optimum time. Because they have tasted different at different times of year. And what I really want is something that is amazing, as well as having had an amazing life, you know, really high welfare, but really, really, really good quality. And if I can't have masses and masses of sheep, which I can't, because I haven't got the land and my back might not be up to it, I'll have to go for quality, not quantity.
Yeah.
So I'll have to go, I'm going to try and go for a sort of a high-end product with my hogget and see if I can market it. Shush, somewhere else.
She can't see it.
There she is.
Is that Noddy?
That's Noddy. Well done.
Looks just like Noddy Holder.
She's so woolly. I actually sheared her face. You wouldn't believe it. Look how fluffy she is now.
It just seems like it's quite hard to make a living out of a smaller scale.
Yeah, I think that if I had more sheep, the costs wouldn't sort of go up in the same rate. You know, if I had a lot more sheep, I've already got most of the equipment that I need. Worming guns and foot shears and all those kind of things that you... Well, I didn't have any of it when I started. So it's just probably more my bravery and my courage of actually expanding and going, oh, my God, I'm actually, you know, responsible for all these animals and running a business, even though at the moment it's not making a massive profit or anything. But it's covering itself. What I'd like it to do is just cover its own costs. Come here. It'd be nice one day to have enough where all I had to do was play with my sheep.
Since I was last here, Brexit has happened.
Yeah.
And that obviously will affect farmers down the line. But I think that's probably going to be people who are quite large scale. Do you have any idea if that's going to affect anything for you? Or do you come under the bar in that you don't get subsidies?
I don't get any subsidies, yeah. I don't own the farm. I don't get affected by a lot of the external things that other normal farmers get affected by, because I just sell my lambs direct to the customers locally. So I don't get affected by market prices, because I've got no sort of middleman. I'm not, like, you know, having to watch the prices going up and down in the Farmers Weekly. And then, you know, Brexit-wise, I'm not exporting anything. I'm not importing anything. I'm a little in a bubble, really.
I do wonder if, when all of that really comes in, if it will cause more people to be smaller scale.
It might cause more people to shop locally a bit more. It might force people into buying British produce.
I just think if we had more people like you, the size that you are, and you got a bit of help, then more people would raise their animals as well as you do and care about it as well.
Maybe. I feel like I don't want anyone to subsidise me. I mean, it's not my farm, so I'm not putting a lot of effort into the upkeep of the farm. The subsidies that you get quite often on a farm are for the things that you do for the benefit of the land, for the wildlife and the environment on your farm, and, you know, the hedges and the ancient trees, any sort of, like, old monuments you might have, beetle banks, that kind of thing. That's, you get points for that and you get money for that. And that's a worry as well with Brexit, because that's all to do with European laws, and without them, depending who's going to be in government, depending who cares about it, who's going to be saying to a farmer, we'll, you know, reward you for looking after your farm in a sensitive fashion. Most of them want to do that, but, you know, if it's not financially viable, it might be easier to, you know, rip that hedge out and make a bigger field, or spray that with something or put a, you know, GM crop in there. You know, that'd be more profitable, because no one's giving you any money not to do it.
So on reflection, at the end of your first year, or it's actually probably about 18 months now, are you pleased that you've done this for yourself?
I am. I've had a couple of wobbles, if not three or four, where I've thought, I want to give this up, I'm going to give it up. And then I go through the process of thinking, how do I give it up? So I have to sell all the sheep, and then, oh, I can't bear the thought of who's going to buy them, will they look after them? And then I think, what am I going to do after that? You know, what job am I going to do? And I just feel really, really sad. And I always knew that if I had my own sheep, it would sort of be the making of me, you know, it would make me be responsible and, you know, give me a real sort of purpose in my life. And it really has.
That was Susanna Steer of Bark and Romney's. It was really good to catch up with her, and I'm glad she's going to persist with it because she's really good at what she does. And the meat really is the best I've ever tasted. So if you're interested in having a look at what she's doing, she does have a Facebook page if you look for Bark and Romney's. And she's also got a website, and I will put all of that on the Growing Wild Show page on RadioReverb.com. Okay, we're coming to the end of the show, and I just wanted to mention a couple of shows back, I interviewed Charlotte Harris, and she was going to do a garden at Chelsea Flower Show, and that has now happened, and as a result of that interview, I actually ended up working on the garden. I spent 6 days up there, and it was the most intense, extraordinary experience. It was very high stress, high pressure, and then lots of pockets of fun and enjoyment within that as well. And to see this garden be created, I mean, I came in a week after it had started, and the core of the build had been done, so I was there for planting week. And just as an assistant to the planters, really, and these people, these women are just incredible at what they do and the artistry that goes into it. I was so impressed. It was brilliant. And I'm really grateful to Charlotte for giving me that opportunity. And she got a gold medal, which was, I'm so pleased for her. It's so brilliant. And so she's raising the profile of female garden designers. To have a garden on Main Avenue at Chelsea is a big deal. And I just want to say congratulations to her. And it was a real pleasure to be part of it. Okay, I'm going to play out with a couple of things. It's been nightingale time. And where I live, I'm fortunate enough to have quite a few of them that come to this one area. It's in East Sussex, and they have very particular requirements for where they set up shop. And that's why we've got such dwindling numbers of them. I think there is a bit of a resurgence, which is good news. But because their habitat requirements are so specific, it's shrubland and it has to be very dense. And that's the sort of thing that doesn't get specifically managed very well. And yeah, so unfortunately numbers have gone down, but it's always such a joy to hear them. They're only around for about 6 weeks, and I actually did a piece with the folk singer Sam Lee where he goes off and he sings with them, and you can probably find that show in the podcasts. But I just wanted to walk down there and just hear them, because you don't have to go down there in the dead of night. You can pick them out in the daylight hours as well, and it's always a joy. So I want to play out with some of their bird song, followed by a song by the birds. So thank you for listening. You can contact me at growingwildreverb@gmail.com. You can find my show page on radioreverb.com and search for Growing Wild. I am on Instagram and Twitter as Growing Wild FM. So many different ways. So thank you very much for listening. I'll be back next month. Go well.
I'd rather go and journey where the diamond crescent's glowing, and run across the valley beneath the sacred mountain, and wander through the forest where the trees have leaves of prisms and break the light in colors that no one knows the names of.